I've done a lot of DSSs, but I'm not sure I've done one quite like this, Ray. It's truly an honor. I mean, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary and you're our DSS guest. I just want to say how special it is for me to spend time and you know, many of the people here will have long memories of working with you and some will have no memories of working with you. So we're gonna fill in the history. And before I get to it, I do want to say the news that came out this morning that we have completed, you and us, the last part of this transition is truly something that should be congratulated. So I just want to.
Yes, thank you, Dan. Thank you, Bob.
Bob and Nir. Nir, to you, Bob, Greg, the board, everyone, is really a fantastic accomplishment. And I think it's something to be celebrated. So with that said, I really want to walk us through 50 years of time. I'm going to step in there when I have to make sure we keep the time constraint.
Good luck.
So the first question I want to ask you is, we're sitting here.
Before you ask me any questions.
Yes.
Let me just say how unbelievable grateful I am, and to so many of you, so many faces, like you say, are people that I've known for many, many years, and I truly love because of what we've done in the 50 years, and then many of you are new folks, so it's great to be able to speak with you, but I can name the people, I see the faces. I see you also in the T-shirt, okay, just get up and show them the T-shirt because, meaningful work, give me meaningful work and meaningful relationships, and anyway, so thank you. This is something else to be able, on this day, to transition completely after 50 years. So thank you all for that. And also, it's good to see you.
And this, we're sitting here in New York City in this beautiful new office location. And if you just imagine 50 years ago, we also were in New York City, in a slightly different location. So you kind of expressed some moments there, but how does that make you feel, just sort of the difference of locations, where we are today, and everything that you've put into this?
Well, so it's a lifetime. It's 50 years. And when I started, what I wanted was meaningful work and meaningful relationships. I had no idea how great it could be, how difficult it could be, all of that. So you can imagine 50 years looking back, and this is my extended family. It was raising a family. And so how does it feel? It feels like the succession. It feels like maybe a father who loves their children and their whatever, who grow up to be adults, and you can see them flourishing and so on. So it feels incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. So let's go back even before 50 years. 1973, you come out of Harvard Business School, and at the time, the oil markets were going crazy, and you decide to go in to the commodity brokerage business, which is very unusual at that time. And you described that decision actually afforded you incredible opportunities that maybe you wouldn't have had at such a young age. Describe. For responsibility, big
okay.
Responsibility. Describe
so it. I had invested in, I'd been in markets since I was a kid, and then I went to commodities futures because they had low margin requirements. So I figured if I'm going to be right, I can make more money with low margin requirements. And because of that in commodities, then when I graduated from Harvard Business School in 1973, I was hired as director of commodities at this brokerage firm. To give you an idea, that wasn't probably a smart decision, but right. Anyway, they hired me as director of commodities, and then they went broke pretty much because the stock market became crummy and the commodity markets were hot and futures were hot. And so then in 1973, that's when I graduated. 1975, I then got fired.
I wonder if anyone's surprised by that, by the way.
What?
Well, it's the getting fired thing, like you working for other people and taking orders. And I'm just wondering if anyone's surprised by that.
Yeah, I don't. They know me that.
But none of us would be here in this space if that didn't all happen, right?
Right.
Right. So you start Bridgewater in 1975.
Right.
In a two-bedroom apartment.
In a two-bedroom apartment. The roommate was in the other apartment. He moved out. And then and I was there. And a guy I played rugby with became sort of my assistant of sorts. And then there was a woman who was helpful in other, you know, assistant and so on. And then I needed a little bit more space. So we went to the basement of this brownstone that I was living in. And it literally was a boiler room operation. I mean, there was a boiler. And we worked in the basement.
Yeah.
And that's how it started, yeah.
Now, I would bet that most people don't that haven't been here for a while, or haven't looked at the history, don't know that in the first 10 years of Bridgewater, from 1975 to 1985, we weren't managing any client money. What were we doing?
What we were doing, and that's when Bob joined. What year did you join?
86.
86.
Okay, 86. Okay, that's just after we got the World Bank account. But what I was doing was advising and then managing positions for companies regarding hedging. Mm-hmm. In other words, they had exposures, and the world was really volatile, and they needed to know how to deal with the their exposures. And because I was in charge of institutional hedging in my prior job, then they wanted that business, and I then traded my own account, and then I gave that advice, and I and a couple of people got into the position of being able to give advice. We did it on a telex, mm-hmm. and so on. And the head of the World Bank at the time received that information. And then I talked with her about the idea of us opening an account. And they gave us a first $5 million account, mm-hmm. Hilda Cho at the World Bank. And I thought $5 million was a lot of money to manage. Mm-hmm. And so that's what got us started. And then we became, Bob joined in 86, and then we became the number one bond manager in the world.
We're going to get to that in a second, but I want to first focus on this period, because you describe that the way you would ultimately give advice is you would try and literally imagine yourself in their shoes, understand their problems at the deepest level, everything that their constraints, their problems, their opportunities, and so on, to the point where if you were them, you would know what you would do.
Exactly.
And then you would, okay.
Yeah.
And that literally became the model for client service.
That's
at
right.
Bridgewater.
That's right.
Which is very unique, right? That wasn't how things were going for money management firms for a long time.
It's an extension, I mean, of the pleasure of the mutual relationship. How would I be if I was in your shoes and so on? And it had big impact. So, yes, you're right. When we think about the relationships for clients and we think about the daily observations, for example, you know, they would want advice every day almost, you know, what's going on in the market. So I put out a telex. I would dictate a telex in this basement with the, it would be typed. And it would go out, and then we had the relationships where we knew what they were doing, and then we would manage those accounts to some extent, and that was great satisfaction. And it's still great satisfaction.
Yeah.
But, of course, it had to be transitioned because I couldn't do all that, and that's how we came up with the idea of client advisors.
Mm-hmm. And then before we get to the point where now Bridgewater is a money manager, let's just go to something you've talked about a lot. 1979 through 82, you were out there, you had started to gain a name for yourself, and you had seen that the interest rate rises that Paul Volcker was putting in could potentially create a depression. And you were not shy about articulating, you were on Oprah, and you were not shy about articulating that view. You even say, in retrospect, you know, when you said, I'm 100% convinced, or something to that effect.
Right, I'm Wall Street.
And you were dead wrong.
Right.
Tell us about that period.
Oh, okay.
It was a dark period, and what did you learn?
So in 1979 and 80, I had calculated that American banks had lent more to countries than they were going to be able to pay back at that interest rate and so on. And I realized we're going to have a debt default. And yes, then I was interviewed, I went to Congress, They asked me about all of this. And in August 1972, Mexico defaults on its debt. And then, through the next 10 years, many other countries defaulted on their debt. And I thought at the time we were going to have a crisis, a debt crisis. And I couldn't have been more wrong. August 1982, when Mexico defaulted on its debts, I wasn't wrong about the debt defaults. I was wrong about the impact on the markets. Mm-hmm. I thought they were going to go down, and they went up a whole lot. And so I lost money for me. I lost money for clients. I had to let people go. It was down to me as an individual, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Am I going to, you know, put on my tie and commute into the city on the railroad, or, you know, and all that, or what was I going to do? But that was the best experience that happened to me. I mean, you know, it's almost the teaching me that pain plus reflection equals progress. There are lessons to be learned in that. And I learned, you know, a couple of lessons which changed everything for the future. I learned, first of all, I learned humility, the fear of being wrong and the questioning myself, how do I know I'm right? You know, arrogance, I needed some humility. Mm-hmm. And then I learned how the power of diversification, because I knew that I can play many bets and lower my risk without lowering my returns by up to 80% if you can get 15 good uncorrelated return streams. So I learned that. And then I learned that I wanted an idea meritocracy. So then we began to build. That was the great bottom that never changed anything from there. From there, we basically, with bumps, some bumps along the way, but no really big performance bumps along the way, all the way. So mm-hmm. That's how we built it. So that lesson was the foundation of Bridgewater, and it exists in my mind, you know, and our portfolio, how we structure portfolios and all that.
I mean, you think about the diagram you always draw, and that's in your books.
That's right. This looping, okay? That looping, because I believe in evolution, and that's personal evolution. In other words, it's the five-step process. You make advances, but then you're going to come across your problems, okay, and your mistakes. And then do you reflect on them and diagnose them to get at the root cause and make changes, in which case you will come up and be better and you'll go to a new high, and that's the constant process. And so I could think about that when we had 1994. We had all of these ways of constantly learning from mistakes, so much so that I've come to appreciate mistakes, because I think of them as they're the best learning experiences if you make
And I think,
most of them.
You know, it's possible that people hear that, but they don't really realize that out of that 1982 experience, the 15 uncorrelated return streams, that was a staple of what had such great impact on clients. The dumb shit, which is the staple of internally training people not to be arrogant, came out of that period, you know. And so my question to you is, like, is that what it is? Like, can people not get to those kind of great understandings without first hitting the depths?
I think that that's largely what it is. There are some other things about what it is. But yes, everybody can succeed if they know their own weaknesses and how that reality works. And everybody thinks, I'm going to get strong in those things I'm weak. But when you start to appreciate how others are different and how you have to have a team and how you have to have high standards for that team and you can work together, then you get a Bridgewater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, 1985. Let me ask you this. Did you know you wanted to go in the investment management business, or is this something that came to you when the World Bank gave you money? You are now an investment manager. Well, did that come to you?
Well,
or?
You know, since I was 12, I knew that I wanted to play the game. So I played the game, and it's very well. I knew that I wanted to play markets and mm-hmm. so on. When I went to the World Bank and so on, then, and I think Hilda Ochoa said, why don't you manage bonds? In other words, they were getting information, but then she sort of said, well, why don't you manage assets? Oh, okay. Yeah, I should manage assets. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started.
Now, one of the biggest first developments when we were managing money is 1987, because 1987 was the big stock market crash. And you caught it. When you and team caught the big stock market crash. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I remember. Well, there was clearly a bubble going on, right? And then and there was the vulnerability. And then I remember that morning. I don't know if you remember the morning, okay? Bob remembers the morning. We were in it together. And they had some storm in London and so on. And this was it. And so I knew there were a variety of indicators. I won't go through it. But I kind of knew that that was going to be, you know, this was a good bet. Mm-hmm. And so we went short. Then I thought, okay, now this is going to be a period of volatility. The next year was not a period of volatility. And then we had the period after that, and that was good. Mm-hmm. But it, again, surprising. Like, for example, you would imagine after the stock market crash that you would have volatility. That was one thing I was always thinking that you would have. Mm-hmm. And then you didn't have the volatility. And so that also, all of these lessons taught me that what we needed to do was to test the rules and have back tests. In other words, be very clear of what the rules, decision rules were, and see how it would have performed over a period of time. And that's what helped.
Now, the next thing of note is, I think, 1990, 1991, because that's when you kind of pioneered this concept of the separation of alpha and beta, which became so central to investing and to our business strategy also. And there's lots to explore here. Just walk us through the separation of alpha and beta, how you came to that, and then we'll build on that from
there. Well, everybody in investing then would say, I'll give you a stock mandate or a bond mandate. This was the way it was, a stock mandate. And then what everybody would do was try to add value within that universe of stocks and bonds. But so that would be your benchmark. Your benchmark was stocks, and then people would time stocks. But alphas can be brought from other areas, so I could port the alphas over. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, we can create alphas from different areas and overlay them on a benchmark to engineer it, which gave a really competitive advantage, because we could take all different alphas, create a diversified portfolio of alphas, and therefore engineer a better alpha. And so we would go to clients and say to them, okay, you can give me a mandate if you let me structure it this way, in which you're going to have the S&P 500, or pick your benchmark, it's okay. We would replicate the benchmark or hold the benchmark and then be able to do this operation with separation of alpha. I think it's because also my futures and my derivatives understanding allowed me to realize that I could separate those two things, and that was an enormous competitive advantage.
And this literally meant, right, we could be, first of all, we didn't, even though we Pure Alpha started with, that was our fullest diversified alpha in 1991, we could take subsections of that. If a client, like if we wanted to be in a currency overlay business and all they wanted currencies, we could start there and then through our client service model start to grow the alpha.
Right. You would pick what was your beta, and then you'd pick what your alphas were, and then we would put them together and to make a better engineered portfolio. And it gave us a huge competitive advantage.
So we could be in the currency overlay business, we were.
Yeah.
We could be in the global bond business, we were. We can be in the emerging market debt business, we were.
In anything.
In any beta where we could port our alpha.
Right.
And I just, like, to this day, I don't know of any other firm that did that, and how differentiating that
was. Well, it was, none did, and it was differentiating.
Now, first of all, in 1986, Bob comes along, so that's predating that, but Bob comes along, Giselle Wagner comes along, Dan Bernstein comes along. How are you recruiting these people to this place called Bridgewater when there's you and some others, but it's not the equivalent of some of the brand names that...
Well, each one of them had the story. I wish I could take the time to tell you Bob's story, you know, and he's at First Oklahoma Bank, and it's a wonderful...
He wrote you a letter, I think.
No, I had my newsletter, and I think he... the newsletter was how much?
$290.
$290. He subscribed to the newsletter, and for $18,000, he could have all my time or something. It was something when he was working down, mm-hmm. down there. And then we got acquainted. And he was, what, 27?
Yeah.
He was 27 years old. And he was a star at 27 years old. We talked about markets. We got into this thing. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And, you know, what are you going for, right? What is your life going to be like? Okay, you can, yeah, there's an entrepreneurial spirit. You can go work at an established bank like First Oklahoma, or you can go do this. And and we like markets, and so he went and did it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So then the 90s become a magical time. That becomes a period of enormous growth, and then we get to basically the tech sell-off.
I want to explain why that is before we
go
get
ahead.
To that,
sure.
That particular ahead. Thing. Okay, because these are the fundamentals. An idea meritocracy, mm-hmm. meaningful work and meaningful relationships through radical truthfulness and radical transparency. Having to deal with, like an intellectual Navy SEALs kind of thing, right? And to be in that together. And so to be what the culture is here, to be super excellent and super rigorous with each other. And so what we did through those other money management things is that the upsides were big, very big. And the downsides were very little by comparison. And we were uncorrelated with other managers. And we were dealing with clients as though we were in their shoes. And like today, they would read the daily observations and we would be able to communicate in a quality way. That was the winning combination of factors. And for the future, that is the winning combination of factors that I think you still have and will continue to pursue, I think.
Now, in 96, Greg comes and joins. But previous to that, in 95, he was an intern. In 1995... Esquire magazine contacts you, says, Ray, we'd love to come over to Wilton at the time, and we'd like to do an interview with you. And you say, yeah, come on. And then something happens during the time that they scheduled the interview, and they come, and you can't do the interview. You don't have time to do the interview. So you say, Greg Jensen, our intern, will do the interview.
Yeah.
So Greg Jensen, I'm just wondering, you got a lot of responsibility when you first came out of business school. Maybe this was your mentality, right? So there's an Esquire 1995 cover with our intern feature. What was going through your head on that one?
Well, so he was, he was an intern, but he was a very bright intern. He got it, and so on.
Yeah.
And I don't remember how many people with experience I had to be able to.
It was actually a very good article.
But it was a great interview,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And he told it was like.
The computer whiz or something like that. It was something like that.
Yeah.
And then there was the other one where, you wrote The Wire every day, the Bridgewater Daily Observations. This is going back to the 80s, but you had to go on a business trip, and so you called Bob, and you said, Bob, I'm on a business trip. I'm not going to be able to write The Wire. Bob was very new to Bridgewater, and you said to him, why don't you write The Wire? And then Bob froze and said, I read The Wire. I don't write The Wire, but he then decided to write The Wire, and your review, the quality review of that Wire was very good. So from then on, you said, Bob, you're now going to write The Wire, and you ruined his life for the next 30 years there.
The key to success is finding great people who can do things wonderful, give you leverage, and also do things better than you can do them.
Now, just after this time, there is a big debate that goes on internally at Bridgewater because, as I mentioned, in the 90s, incredible growth and success despite a painful drawdown, 99 through 01. But still, nonetheless, the decade really starts to establish Bridgewater. And there is a debate that starts to take place internally about should Bridgewater hold its growth and kind of remain a boutique, or do we really want to go hard and make Bridgewater an institution?
That's right.
First of all, who is lining up on what side of that debate?
Giselle was...
Giselle Wagner, who was our former chief of financial...
Right, was lining up in...
Chief operating officer.
In boutique.
Yeah.
I lined up in terms of go for it.
Yeah.
I think... where were you?
Bob wanted to go for it.
Yeah, okay, he wanted to go for it.
And but what was the nature of the debate, Ray?
Greg was go.
What was the nature of the debate?
The debate was around as much around culture and that aspect, or quality. Mm-hmm. Could we maintain the quality when we were going from that level to the next level? And I viewed it as I think quality is of paramount importance. And I think that when we looked at all of our needs, the needs of back office, the needs of legal, the compliance, and all those financial needs, to be able to have the capabilities, they really were better served mm-hmm. by being able to have those resources to be able to go for it. So we went for it.
Right.
And I viewed that as the challenge. How would we be able to do that? That was also cultural. I connected it to radical transparency, mm-hmm. right? Radical truthfulness and radical transparency and writing down principles. Principles first came from investment principles that we can back test and so on. But then also then the principles of every time I would make a decision or we would make a decision, I'd write down the criteria for making those decisions. And then I wanted everybody to see everything. So everything was shown, so anybody could see everything, including our stumbling, mm-hmm. All of that stuff. And that was what helped to keep it together and then go for it. The together behind the mission is an incredibly important force. You either have it or you don't. And so that's what, and it turned out to be very successful.
Did you find that the struggle from going from a boutique in the beginning parts of going to an institution was harder than you imagined?
Yeah, the hardest part was the technology part. Because like I was in, I think about Claude and the other people who were involved.
Claude Amadeus.
And Rod Bruce. Is Rob Bruce here?
If he isn't, he's watching in Connecticut.
Okay. Hey, Rob. Mm-hmm. Okay. He knows, we went through this. Okay. Because my original view of the technology was, I wanted to build it fast, figure it, it's adapting and all of that. And then that created a technology hairball. Because we didn't have the documentation behind it. People would change, technologies would change. And then I learned, and we all learned together, that, oh my God, we have this technology hairball. That was our biggest problem. Mm-hmm. The other parts were fine. We would bring in the people. That's how client advisors developed. As you recall, mm-hmm. like when I found out that I couldn't be there or somebody else couldn't be there, we would have mocks, mm-hmm. right? And the mocks would be, I would play the role of a client and you would play the role of the client advisor and then I would grill you and so on and so forth.
It's actually, you were grilling me. I was the strategist and you were grilling
strategist,
me.
Yeah.
Yes, and we had a group.
Strategist,
the client advisors did the same thing.
Yeah, but no, but a strategist was the right term.
Yeah.
A strategist was supposed to be the person who would replicate mm-hmm. me or Bob or Greg and so on. So there were the growing adjustments. In other words, I couldn't do it personally, but then you get the leverage from great people.
Yeah.
And so we figured our way to do that.
Yeah. Let's fast forward to another, in my view, this was a seminal moment, just unbelievable. So 2006, around the same time, it's becoming clear, it's not actually, I shouldn't say that. There are warning signs that the mortgage market is going through the roof, that more and more speculative housing, and you can see it in the wires. If you go back and you look, you can see the buildup where the research is starting to point to the danger and the bubbles and so on.
And we would not have seen that if we didn't study the Great Depression to understand the nature of the risks.
Right. Explain.
Well, I mean, the big risk is, they could always lower your interest rates and send money in. But what happens when they hit a zero interest rate when you have a debt crisis?
Mm-hmm.
The last time that happened was 33.
Right.
And so there was no time that you would have seen that if you didn't see March of 1933 when the interest rates hit zero. Okay. And what did they do? And that was the last time they did. That was quantitative easing. You would not have understood the nature of that dynamic. So it was from that point, okay, not only did we catch the 2008 down move, 2009 we went almost neutral.
But I want to keep going at this. By the way, if you go back and you look at the daily observations going back to 2001, there was this notion in the markets at the time called pulling on a string.
Mm-hmm.
But you thought there's a chance here that we may be in that kind of environment then, mm-hmm. because you may not be able to get out.
That's why 2000.
That took you to the Great Depression.
2008 was the bust.
Yes.
2009. I honestly didn't know what was going to happen.
Right. And the thing you kept pointing out internally is that the higher these debts go, the more sensitive they are to interest rates. So you basically have to cut further and you were going to run out of room. And that was the problem.
Right.
Okay. So now 2007, I just remember all these times we had people coming up to see us. Maybe it was 2008 at the time, the banks that ultimately, you know, the brokerage.
2008.
Yeah. They got in big trouble.
We had the incidents, and then we were right, and then it was helping others to S&P, the guy who runs S&P, and he has to give ratings, and we went through his ratings and showed why his ratings were wrong, and he didn't mark to market, mm-hmm. and so on, and so then a lot of people started to come in. I think that's probably what you're referring to.
Now, in 2007, 2008, beginning of 2008, walk us back. How confident were you that we had it, that we understood just how grave this was, even if others were just starting to come to that recollection or didn't understand? How confident were you at that time?
I learned my humility,
right.
and I learned to be scared of being wrong through my particular experiences.
Confident?
It sure damn looked like it, and it happened before, and it made sense, but there's the question of how much you're going to bet on it. And so when you say confident, I always come up with the template of how it's likely to go, who I believe it's likely to go, and then I follow things against that template. Mm-hmm. And it was operating like that template, but, you've got to see, what do they do?
And
so I would say, I was maybe 70% confident.
And when you look at the fact that started to play out that way, how worried were you that even if you were right, this whole system could come down and that Bridgewater couldn't operate without a system? How worried were you about that?
Well, I was worried about, the terribleness of such an economic circumstances. And I mostly felt that we were serving a real purpose for our clients because they were losing money everywhere else. And we were making money for them. And then it's just like being in the battle, You think about the battle, and then, beyond, you figure about after the battle, you think about beyond.
I mean, it's hard not to be happy about those years. But I remember you writing some emails and so on. We get them kind of from near now, which is enjoy maybe this much, but worry more.
That's right. Okay, I remember a meeting with Parag, and everybody wants to celebrate and says how terrific we are, and we want to celebrate. And I remember this meeting with, stop that. I mean, okay, otherwise you worry. Worry about being weak and missing stuff and so on. Yeah, so I have a principle. If you worry, you don't have to worry. And if you don't worry, you need to worry. Because if you worry, you will take care of the thing you're worrying about. Okay, and you'll be okay.
Yeah. All right, the next big thing is 2013, because in 2013, it looked like Europe was just going to come apart.
Well, this started really in 2010.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2009 and 10, it was the same for me with Europe as it was going down to Washington in 2007. I went down to Washington in 2007.
Right.
And I'm like, I think it was just in the Financial Times, Gillian Tett describes how I come with this pile of papers and I want to explain. And she threw the papers in the trash can. And Paulson and so on said, okay, and I'm just figuring, please just go through the numbers and see what that was the same in 2009 and 10 before the European crisis happened. And I was lucky because Mario Draghi would sit down and some element of talks, but they still didn't believe it. They believed that the markets would adapt and correct things and the markets are right and so on. And they don't understand, which is a very important principle, that There's a supply-demand issue, and you're not calculating. Don't wait for it to happen. And so that started really 2009 and 10, dealing with that. And then going through that, then I was really lucky in the sense of that I can help them think about how to deal with it. Like, how do you do monetization in Europe when you have independent, you have the constitutional court in Germany and so on and so forth. But that's what, go ahead.
So these countries had, you know, especially Spain and Italy and Greece had no degrees of freedom in their fiscal because it was all centralized. That's what you're referring to. And so how do you then deal with that? And so what was the advice that you gave Mario?
Because the German constitutional court was standing in the way of this and so on, I asked if you did it proportionately across everything, then you're not, then could you do it? And you could, essentially quantitative easing and doing other ideas. And so that's when they did it.
Now, if you look back, again, the growth of the 90s, all the events in 2000.
And by the way, let me just emphasize, many people were involved in these discussions, many of Bridgewater people. And so it was this great team that would wrestle around with the questions.
By the time that we get to the middle of the 2010s, you're a very well-known person. Bridgewater's a very well-known firm.
Which was a problem.
Tell us how. Tell us why.
Well, I think it was I don't know exactly what year it was, but we wanted to stay below the radar. Mm-hmm. And then when we became the largest hedge fund, and then people were thinking this is a cult, weird place, and so on. Stories began to emerge about the cult, And so then I was put into a position, what do I do about that? And what I did is I put out the Book of Principles. It wasn't a book. There were, a handbook. It's about this book. I put that out, and I put it out online. And there were 3 million downloads of this. And then people started to talk about that culture, that way of being, and so on. And then it became more, it was the combination of being the largest hedge fund and so on. So I had to deal with, and we had to deal with, the question of what does it mean to be public, because we couldn't avoid it anymore.
All right, so let's go to 2019, late 2019, this COVID starts we think in China, and it's spreading around. And in 2020, I remember Richard Falkenrath was increasingly warning us about this and so on. And, we had the, 1920, I believe it was, or 1922?
1918.
Pandemic, but we didn't really have a lot of sample on these pandemics and so on. And we didn't really manage it very well. So let's go back and reflect on what was coming at you and the team, and how are you processing that, and then any reflections you have on that?
Well, my whole approach is, did it ever exist in history? How does it work mechanistically and so on? And there was no sample size, and it would come as a surprise. So I was, then what we did is we decided that we would take positions and we'd take options protections against those positions. Because other things would say, be long, but on the other hand, wow, this is something. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we worked ourselves through it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
big positions when you're not sure. So you would cut positions or option protect the positions. But I want to mention a few other things.
Please.
May I?
Yes, go
okay.
ahead.
The culture is very, very important. The culture is the most important thing. And so there were certain decisions along the way, I think, that were important. And this was what I want to emphasize, people who would get sick or maybe die or have family relatives who die and have diseases, to be there at each other's weddings and funerals and so on. I mean, people in the audience know how we were in terms of, okay, we as a group would go to, and I remember so many that we would go to their funerals or celebrate their weddings or the babies and these kinds of things, okay? I want to make sure that that is conveyed as being very important in terms of the meaningful work and meaningful relationships. And I think you still do those kinds of things. So I just didn't want to go through performance and investment decisions and so on with leaving out those dimensions of what it really means to be meaningful, having meaningful relationship, particularly in bad times for the people. And you have to make decisions. There were a bunch of principles that I would, what do you do when somebody's dying of cancer, mm-hmm. or their spouse is dying of cancer and they need space? How do you deal with that? You have to write down principles. It gets you to think. Mm-hmm. So that was an important thing. Another important thing was China. Mm-hmm. You know, curiosity. And I went to China in 1984 only because of curiosity and the interest. Like, this isn't just a money-making business. Money-making was secondary, okay? Be as great as you can be. But curiosity to go to China, and then the relationships to help them build up markets and the economy and develop those relationships. Those dimensions, which are now those that you can keep carrying forward. This is happening in different countries. Indonesia has a new sovereign wealth fund that could use help. And how do you build those relationships? So I just wanted to emphasize that aspect too before we go on to your next question.
Well, the last question I was going to ask you was, you know, we're sitting here at 50 years and now the people in front of you and on the screen and so on, they're going to be responsible for getting us off to the next 50 years. And I think the question for you is, like, what are the key tenets you would want us to internalize in order to raise the probability of success near and far term, you know, as we move forward?
Well, they're all in the book. They're all in Principles, Life, and Work, okay? And there's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And but I would also say that you also have to do it in your own way. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's like a generation, you know, thing. Mm-hmm. You go from what parents. And I look at, okay, now you're the next generation. And what do I want from you? I want you to do it for your own way. I want you to like your parents feel about you. What do they want for you? They want you to be successful without them. In other words, but have a great relationship with them. So that's my aspiration. And you have to learn by banging yourself and so on, and you know these principles, and how do you have an idea meritocracy and those things, because those are the best principles I can pass along, and then what you do is up to you.
Right. Okay. Well, that's...
But 50 years. Wow. Do you know, I mean, you know how few companies have lasted 50 years, let alone maintaining at the edge, you know? Okay. So it works.
Does. I just want to tell you again, like, I'm not sure I'm ever going to get this opportunity again, and it's very special to me. So I hope you enjoy everything that you put in here and continue to be the daily observations. You come right through me and podcasts and stay involved with us because we love you, and you'll be our founder and our guiding light. And so congratulations, Ray, on this whole thing.
And I love you too. Okay? And so I want to continue to have this loving relationship. Thank you for it. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for allowing me to have that relationship. So, you know, I'll always be there appreciating this. Thank you very much.
Give Ray a hand.